You'll be here shortly.
Okay. The House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome. We have three items on our agenda today. We have a constitutional problem with Senate Bill 428. We're going to hold that over until Monday.
Open a work session.
I have to open it?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 428. We'll hold that over till Monday. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 428. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 348. Senator Morissette. And Sherry Stock. Kevin, do you want to give a brief summary?
Chair Gelson, members of the committee, Senator Morissette is here to speak on the bill, but this measure requires school districts to ensure that coaches receive annual training recognizing symptoms related to concussions and how to seek proper medical treatment. It also charges the State Board of Education with some rulemaking authority with respect to this. This does declare an emergency and is effective July 1st, 2009.
Thank you very much. Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for hearing the bill. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, Lynn County. Senate Bill 348 is a very important bill that we passed out of the Senate a month ago. It deals with traumatic brain injury, and it deals with sports, not only football, but all sports. It had a section in it that would have required school districts to replace helmets as needed, but that was taken out for fear of a fiscal that might have derailed the bill. However, school districts regularly monitor, I hope, their helmets, and I think that will be part of the coach's training, which is required by the bill. There is no fiscal. The Department of Ed is fine with this, and one of the companion pieces that we have is a kit that comes from the CDC, which was made available to every single coach in the state of Oregon at one point, and will again be made available to them, and this will serve as the basis for coaches' training because it goes into fairly good, great detail. There's a CD from the CDC, and an instruction book, and Tom, I believe his name is Walter from the OSAA, who is not here today, is very much supportive of this program, and he will oversee, in a sense, the compliance as the Department of Ed will. The coaches are going to be responsible for following the guidelines of training. Ultimately, the principals will be responsible. The school boards will be responsible because there's a line of command that goes up, and if something bad happens, there are liability problems. What the main part of the instruction is concerning is identifying the symptoms of concussion. So if someone is, for instance, playing women's soccer and comes out of the game as a result of head butting or bumping as they do headers, then that person will be looked at carefully by the coach who knows the symptoms, and they will have to make a decision as to whether or not that person will go back in and play again. Now, after boys' football, women's soccer has the most serious injuries, almost twice as much as men's soccer, and that's interesting. I'm not sure what all of the reasons are, but I think headbutting or headers and maybe falling. The other interesting thing is that falling can be almost as bad, in some cases worse, than hitting your head. because the woman who died on the ski slopes did not bump her head. She had a very violent whiplash, and as a result of that had internal bleeding, was conscious. If someone had been there and recognized the symptom, that she would have survived if they had been able to relieve the pressure. The blood clot caused her brain to die, and she died as a result of that. So there are a lot of things to that we have to be careful of in terms of concussions and boxing, which I was a ring announcer for a match two Saturdays ago, and I kept thinking, why am I here? I'm dealing with brain injury. And these guys and kids wear the helmets to protect them, their ears and so on, but there's no face guard to protect them from getting hit in the face. In fact, I have blood on my program to show that, because it was splat. There was a doctor who stopped one or two matches and examined them, but when you think of it, the object of boxing is to knock the person out, give them a concussion, cause their brain to stop functioning for a little while, which is pretty scary. And the other thing, concussions can be the causes, well, they can be a cumulative effect. I mean, you can have a number of hits, and eventually it can cause some serious damage. So, now, the other interesting bill that was passed that I carried last week had to do with traumatic brain injury, and that was a mandate for insurance companies to cover the cognitive recovery in traumatic brain injury. And interestingly, the insurance industry did not oppose it, and they said so during the testimony. Many insurance companies around the country already cover that. So this is a very serious issue, and our children are very vulnerable, and so hopefully you will pass this bill out. And with that, I will end and answer questions if you wish.
Thank you. Maybe we'll hear from Ms. Stock first and then take questions for both of you. Welcome.
Hello, my name is Sherry Stock. I'm the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association. And this is Max's Law and Senate Bill 348. And it does focus on annual concussion training for all coaches, and to be done through the community level rather than through the Department of Education, so there won't be a cost to the state or to the school systems. The trainings already exist. As Senator Morissette said, that Center for Disease Control has already created something, and so have a number of other organizations. OHSU has a training. The center in Bend has created a training. The ORCAS down in Eugene has created training. So the trainings already exist. It's just getting every coach to participate in the training. Every coach did receive a copy of the Heads Up concussion kit, and probably maybe one out of 10, if even that many, ever opened it. And so by participating in the training, they will learn this. Also, what this law will do is enable them to tell an athlete and their parents that they can't go back into play because it's the law. Because the pressure from parents as well as from the other athletes and themselves is to get back into play. They don't want to be a wimp and sit it out because they hit their head or were hit on the head. And the reason football has so many concussions is because it's a pretty violent sport. It's the most violent sport that our children play. And football injuries and have brain injuries at about one concussion every 3.5 games. So all the kids are having brain injuries. There was a study done of football players. They expected to have about professional players, about 20%. 20 to 30% showed that they had concussions. 100% showed that they had concussions. That was something that hadn't been expected. In the packet of handouts that I sent around is a letter of support from Drew Bledsoe. Drew is a former football player for the Dallas Cowboys, the New England Patriots, and is a local Walla Walla High School graduate. and is very supportive of this legislation, and I think that's about it. The rate of brain injury is very high, but in children's sports, 80 to 90% are mild, but the few that aren't, the 20% that are moderate to severe, cause a severe lifelong disability and are a lifelong disability that is a cost to society in loss of job and potential, as well as the cost of sustaining those people. So we have a number of people that are going to present, and everything from DVD to PowerPoint. But if anybody has any questions, I'll be glad to answer those.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask, because we've got another bill on the agenda that probably will take a lot of time. I had not anticipated this to take more than about a half hour on the agenda.
Yeah, each person's going to do 3 minutes or less.
Okay, great. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Yes, of course.
Except you. Are there any questions for this panel before they go away?
Yes.
You cannot escape.
No.
I think I heard you talk about being abused in another hearing.
I didn't wear my don't abuse sign.
You didn't, and therefore you have to stay and answer questions. Representative Comp.
Thank you. Just a couple of questions, Senator Morissette. It doesn't say whether there's no clarification about coaches in high school or middle school. It's just I want to get this on the record. It is the intent of this bill that it doesn't matter what grade level you're a coach, that you're going to be asked to do this training.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Comp. The intent is that the coaches, all of the coaches in the district, are going to have some knowledge of the symptoms of concussions. Yes.
Thank you. Follow up. Madam Chair. Do you have any idea how many football coaches are in our state?
No.
A lot.
The head of the OSSA, I'm sorry he's not here today, because
that's all right.
He has been involved with this, and he has taken it upon himself to make sure that he informed me that these packets had already been distributed, and they're going to be distributed again, and he will make sure that this becomes part of the school routine. Also, that qualified physician or qualified medical people must also be consulted. Now, we don't know what that means. Exactly. I mean, a qualified, it could be a trainer, an athletic trainer, and some teams have that or have access to it. Or if not, then they're going to have to go to a doctor and have that person examined if there is an identification of a concussion. So there are some fairly stringent rules.
Just one last follow-up and then a comment, if I might, and I'll be very brief. The term athletic directors, because the athletic directors are almost, a lot of them are always at these functions too, but that's not identified
in
the bill.
No, I didn't mean an athletic director.
No, I mean, Senator.
A trainer, an athletic.
No, I'm asking the definition of an athletic director, like at a high school.
No.
It's not identified in this bill that they receive the training.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't know if that's something we want to add, but they are a critical piece of the of this to make sure these things happen.
As I understand the chain of command, it will go from the coach through the school board, that everyone is going to be aware and responsible for the training. And and that will be part of the as the OSAA initiates their training, that's what they will make sure of.
And just a comment real briefly. Being a high school administrator, our high schools were really very progressive in trying to make sure that the helmets were upgraded and all those things. And then I became a middle school principal. Oh, goodness. The condition of our football helmets was unacceptable. And so we could not afford to buy new ones. We did have them retrofitted, and so that they would, so they could be appropriate protection. But I really thank you for bringing this forward.
Okay, thank you,
Representative Thatcher.
Well, excuse me. I'm just questioning why annual training, and maybe you did talk about it and I missed it, mm-hmm. but it seems like we have first aid certification that's good for a little. Is that what you're trying to do is line that up?
Well, I guess the annual training, I know every year we have in-service training in the school district. I was a teacher for 30 years. I'm sure that the coaches, there'll be new kids, there could be new coaches, there's new personnel, and so to review this and go through it every single year, I think would fit in with the routine.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you.
Representative Stock. I'm sorry. Sherry Stock, Sherry Springer.
There we go. Well, Ms. Stock, thank you for your testimony. You'd made the comment that there'd be no cost to the state or the school district in this training. So are these kits free?
Yes.
The kits are free from the CDC.
Okay. And you also, follow up, please.
Follow up.
And you also made the comment that the training would be done locally.
Right.
Through whom?
Community resources, whether it be the local hospital, support the Brain Injury Association, other associations that work that would provide those kind of trainings. There'll be a uniform training policy, and we'll just make sure that it happens. A lot of the coaches have annual meetings where they training meetings, and it will be incorporated into those kind of things as well. So whichever is the best way, because it's easy to do it right here in the Tri-County area. But when we get out into eastern Oregon, then we'll be more creative in getting those trainings out to everyone. But it will be something to be done.
Yeah, we do have a doctor and a lawyer that are going to be speaking to this. And they drove down together. So I'm not sure how they're going to cover their topic. But this has been vetted very carefully with the medical community. And I'm sorry that Dr. Keister was not able to be here today from Lane County, because he is the expert on this. But it's been pretty thoroughly put together.
Thank you. And before we get to Representative Van Orman, I think our committee administrator has a question.
Senator Morissette, I just want to make sure, because I was looking at this. Mm-hmm. I don't see a reference to just football. This applies to all sports, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I just wanted to clarify that, because
thank
sure
you.
There was some.
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gill. Sir, as a person who's had, fallen and hit her head, just riding her bike, it's not just kids in sports in schools that get hurt and have head injuries. And one of the questions I had, because last week we talked about the first aid card and that districts were giving out these first aid cards, and my understanding of the first aid card is the Red Cross provides the training, but the question then arises, based on what you're talking about, does the Red Cross first aid training, that my understanding that school personnel are required to take, not include this information?
It doesn't include that information, no.
Thank you.
The other thing, several years ago we passed a bill, Senator Clarno and myself, called Tyler's Law, that requires every person under 16 who rides a scooter, a skateboard, or on skates have a helmet. It's the law. All kids have to wear a helmet. Many of them don't. There was a big promotion of it at the time, but that is critical that they have their helmets on.
Thank you. Representative Roblin, did you have a question? Are there any further questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you. And I know we're a little behind, so we'll go until about 1:40 on this bill, and then we'll have to move on to the next one. So next we have, and maybe if you can pull up an extra chair, we'll bring all four up. Lisa Millett, Jim Chestnut, David Krakke, and Bob Jundis, please. Welcome, and you can start in whatever order makes the most sense to all of you.
I'll jump right in. My name is Lisa Millett, and I'm the Injury Prevention and Epidemiology Manager at Oregon's Public Health Division and Department of Human Services, and we're here to testify in support of this bill. The heads-up curriculum that Senator Morissette has talked about is a great step forward in preventing sports injuries with kids. I served on an advisory committee to see CDC reviewing this curriculum when it came back up for review a year and a half ago. One of the things that we're really interested in from the department is working with the Brain Injury Association and coaches to help them, once the coaches learn about the standardized criteria for looking at kids to see if they may have experienced a head injury, teaching coaches how to pass that information on to the Rooters Club, the youth themselves, and the parents who all put pressure on the kids to get back in the game. So it's more than just getting the coaches to be aware of and using the standardized card that comes with this particular curriculum is a really nice piece that can be carried on a coach's clipboard. It has actual standards that they can look at, behavioral indicators that they can look at, and we think that it gives the coaches an opportunity to use those standards and talking points with parents and talking points with kids. Nobody wants to get out of the game, and so that's one of the problems with head injury. Another problem is there are more non-school club sports than there are school club sports in the state. So eventually we'll have to be getting at that as well. And the last point I wanted to make is, I think Dr. Chestnut's going to talk more about the brain injury in itself, right? Okay, and that's all I have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Gelsert. My name is David Cracky, committee members. I come here wearing three hats. I'm a happily married father of two young girls, both of whom play soccer. I'm also a board member of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. I'm also an attorney. In my profession, I represent individuals with brain injuries, and I've seen the devastating effects that brain injuries cause. We're going to hear from Ralph and Max shortly, so I don't think I need to go into that. I think it's understood. This is fundamentally an educational bill, and I think that what was brought up by Representative Comp with regard to the helmets and how awful they are in the middle schools, that puts even more of an emphasis on the educational component. These concussions are going to happen. They are going to happen whether we have good helmets or not, and so it's up to the coach at that point, because truly the kids are going to want to go back in. That's unfortunately just a fact of life, but if a coach understands these signs and symptoms because of this basic training, then we avoid what happens with second impact syndrome. And I think Dr. Chestnut will talk briefly about that, but in a nutshell, that is a strange phenomenon that occurs physiologically, where one concussion occurs, there's a chemistry that occurs with some calcium type of influx into the cells in the brain, making those brain cells that much more susceptible to a second impact. When that second impact occurs, the results can be devastating. Both individual impacts, concussions, may not have very serious results if they are spread out temporally. However, if they are within a certain temporal time period, they can be devastating. What this bill addresses is the education for the coach to know that, hey, this player may have suffered a concussion. Let's have them checked out by a medical professional, and for goodness sakes, let's not play them until they have been cleared to play. Without it, there's some devastating consequence. I've had to do this, luckily, because of my profession. I am trained to recognize these types of symptoms. I recognized symptoms such as these with one of my soccer players, coach my U12, under-12 daughter's soccer team, and I made her sit out. I advised the parents, and they had her checked out. She was cleared, and she was playing the next week. I felt very fortunate to have had that education, and that's essentially what this bill is going to provide to all of the other coaches. I agree that this should go further than scholastic coaches. I think that the rec league should. In fact, I'm working with Dr. Chestnut with the Portland Youth Soccer Association to get some sort of concussion training out to all of the coaches, because they are primarily just parents such as myself. I know that we're busy today, and we have many people that will speak, so I'll leave it at that, and I thank you and urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Chestnut.
Hello. I don't know if this PowerPoint works, but I can put up just a little bit there. It may or may not be up there. But basically, I am a family medicine doctor, certified sports medicine, and I teach concussion management to the medical students as well as across the state. And I also have a busy clinical practice in sports medicine. I happen to have high school athletes in my children, and I also coach sports. So I see it from a number of different perspectives. I work with Dr. Mick Keister, who he mentioned earlier, to oversee the OSAA concussion management program. And basically, that program, we're trying to institute a program like this, but it's hard to get going without a little bit of help from legislature on that. And so basically, we find that there's new concussion science out there that shows us that what we should change the practice that we've been doing for a number of years. And I don't know if this works and whether you want to see it, but
we're trying to figure it out. Usually we have to know ahead of time about the PowerPoint so that the AV team can come down and put all this stuff. So they're trying to figure it out, but we may not be able to get
that. That's totally fine. So the long and short of it is that we know that we used to let kids go back in 15 minutes if they had a resolution of their concussions, and we now know that 15 minutes is not long enough. So there was international guidelines in 2004 that came across that said no same-day return to sport. Those recommendations haven't trickled down to the high school level. They're starting to. And in 2008, I'm on the OSAA Medical Advisory Board, and we passed a resolution to enact the no same-day return to play guidelines. However, they're kind of sporadically being enforced right now. And so there is new evidence out. There's a new international concussion conference that will be published this month in the American Journal of Sports Medicine to recommend our new guidelines, which is really going to follow the same lines, but to keep people out for that competition, to monitor their symptoms, see if they go away. Once they go away, there's a graded return to sport over 1 week, and if symptoms return, they're put back under rest. We also know that it's important for the school district to be involved because this affects their academic achievements and abilities, and we now recommend kids be out of school if they have concussion symptoms for anywhere from a couple days to a couple weeks. I see about 4 to 6 concussion patients a week right now, and the effects are devastating, particularly in those who have been let to go back in by coaches. One girl I'm seeing had 3 concussions in 1 week with people kind of the know, even including parents, not knowing what to do with that. So I've helped the Beaverton School District and the Portland School District with yearly education programs, and we're using a system called IMPACT, which is a laptop-based neuropsychological testing to help us get more information about when a child is ready to go back in. Symptoms are the important thing, but neuropsychological changes like cognition lag behind symptoms sometimes. So there is a little bit of a cost to that, but that we're not talking about implementing that program, but the OSA is encouraging schools to do so, and the Beaverton High School system asked us to help them last year, and we did that, and it seems to be very effective. But the basic education is what needs to be there. The coaches can easily get this in their yearly training if it's recommended and enforced. It'll be added. I've been giving it to the Portland School District coaches for 15 years now, but the problem is I have to keep up to date so that I can get the coaches up to date, and the coaches right now are not up to date, and the standard of care is not being implemented across the state evenly, and I think that this type of program will help a lot. I don't want to spend too much time on this because I've talked over it, but basically, we've all lived through brain injuries. I think this shows that we used to think there's only 300,000 a year, and we now think it's at least 10 times that many, and 9% of all sports injuries are this, and if you extrapolate that to OSAA participation statistics, that's about 6,000 concussions per year, and that's being grossly under-reported right now and under-treated. These are the statistics for injury rate per 1,000 exposures. We all think about football, but it's clearly not just a football program, and it is actually becoming a women's or girls' sport epidemic, and we think that it's a lot of it has to do with weak neck muscles in girls relative to boys, and that's one theory among others that are being studied right now. So it really is important to not just treat it as football like we've been doing, and to get it through the youth soccer and through the girls' sports as well. There are a lot of symptoms that keep people behind. Cumulative impairment can occur.
There are tools out there, and this is one of them. This is very similar to the one we see in the Heads Up, and these are the type of symptoms we have everybody learn and assess. And so things that just being in a fog, headache is the worst. There was a boy this year in New Jersey that died after going back. He died from second impact syndrome because he had a persistent headache that didn't tell the coaches and his parents, and he was let to go back in a week after his concussion. So even despite our best efforts, we can have problems. But the key thing is we've been sending kids back too early. I just want to go forward to these are the new recommendations. No same-day return to play. Return to play approximately 1 week out. We actually can get a football player to get back to the next game the next week. And the argument is basically that we're keeping them safe, but they're able to play by the next game if they follow the graded return to play, which is basically this. And, so basically some of the coaches have put up some roadblocks this because they really didn't know what the program was. They thought it would keep their players out, but it gets them back in a reasonable amount of time, and it keeps them safe and allows them to perform better. And this takes about a week to get back in. It's a little more difficult in soccer because you pretty much miss one game. But we have this OSA program that's trying to establish statewide physician network, uniform evaluation and management protocols, and kind of a consultation network. So we actually have the pieces in place to kind of help this from the medical side. I've spoken to about 12 different physician organizations over the last year and a half, and Mick Keister has done about the same amount. So I think we're ready for the coaches to get the education they need to implement the current best medical practices. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much. Bob.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon, and thank you for allowing me to speak briefly in support of Senate Bill 348. Our organization receives money from the federal government to advocate on behalf of people with traumatic brain injury, and we see on a day-to-day basis the effect that injury can have in the areas of medical services and housing and employment and education, all the aspects of life that can be significantly and severely affected. We would prefer to have fewer customers, and this is a very effective way to do that, and that is why we support the bill. I just want to make one personal note, is that as a ex-high school and college athlete, I still make the mistake of going out and playing from time to time. And about a year ago, I was playing basketball, and a friend of mine who was about my age tripped and fell and hit his head, and he was unconscious. We revived him, dragged him off to the sideline, and continued to play. He then said he was ready to come back in, so we let him back in. And then he kind of wandered around for about 5 minutes, and then we told him to sit down and got him to a hospital. But I tell this to you because it's not just kids. I can tell you as an athlete that the desire, the incentive, and the pride of going back onto the playing field after you sustained injury is very strong. And I think that this bill would help to enculturate our schools and our athletes to understand that there's times where that isn't appropriate. And so I think it's a really good piece of legislation.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you. I just wanted to agree. I think getting out into the club sports is so important. You're talking about the coaching and the soccer. We've got two girls in AYSO soccer, and those are hundreds of boys and girls out every weekend on the soccer fields. And I look at our U10 girls in particular, and they are falling and bumping, and it is a rough sport out there. And even at that age, those girls want to get right back in there. They don't want to be down.
Varsity lacrosse.
Thank you very much. All right, I'm going to close the...
Love it.
Sorry,
we
didn't get
yeah, two games last night. No,
they came
my
from
son
Ben
plays.
To do a presentation.
Okay, we have only about 2 minutes left. Otherwise, we'll lose time to move the bill out of the committee.
Okay.
So, if you can be very brief.
Yeah, I can be real brief.
Thank you.
It's very important.
All right.
Hang on.
What...
My dad.
Not your dad.
My name is
we can tell. We can tell.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time. When the doctor told me that he wasn't going to make it, I decided that
we needed to look into this. And so let me start by introducing Max and let him make a quick statement.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here, and I'll get right to it. In October of 2001, I was a senior at Walport High School on the Oregon coast. I had a 3.95 GPA. I only had one B. It was in my freshman art class. So now I love art.
We'll have to talk to that teacher.
On October 19th, I was our team's quarterback and defensive end. And when I suffered a few hits, I collapsed at halftime during a game. And I was rushed to the hospital. They couldn't air flight me because it was too foggy. Mm-hmm.
Going too long.
All right.
You're doing great. We can take a couple extra.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank that.
Okay.
I suffered a traumatic brain injury. I was in a coma. I was almost dead for 2 months. I was in a coma for 2 months. Can you believe that? And now, I heard lately, I was in a coma. I was in a walking coma for another 2 months. So 4 months in a coma, former comatose. And now I'm living in an adult foster home in Salem here. I don't know the mascot here, but go whatever.
Beavers always works if you're not sure.
Oh, no.
There you go.
Thank you.
That's right.
Come on, Ken. All right. I had a dream about being a sports journalist, but it's been on hold for many years. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you pass my bill. It will make an amazing difference in high school and middle school kids' lives. So thank you very much for listening.
Anyway, while Max was clinging to life, I just assumed this was just like some kind of a freak accident. But we hired an attorney and got investigators, and it comes up, he's wearing a 20-year-old helmet. You have the test scores of that helmet there. It failed virtually all of the standards of the year in which he was playing. If you look at that, they're all highlighted, okay? That's not the only helmet in Oregon that would fail these tests. So that's why it's so critical. I have a whole lot more to say, but I'm not going to say it right now because we're pretty much out of time. But at least, you know, if you've got a lousy helmet and you get a concussion, at least then you can recognize you've got a concussion and treat that so you don't get second impact syndrome. And, you know, his coach didn't have it looked at. I was never informed, and this is pretty much why we're here today. We have a very brief video I would love to show you. Gives you
please.
Some real background. Yeah, it would be.
Please. Let's see it.
All right.
Yes. Thank you, Chair.
My children have softened me up.
Go, Gelser. Go.
I'd like to point out, I have noticed that all the questions came from women, and you'll see one of the physicians, he's not going to make that statement, but he did say, we need to get through to the women.
Yeah.
Men are more likely
Mom.
To go, shake it off. You know, I played, I'm okay. You didn't play, huh?
But my dad never played football.
November 4th, 2007.
Audio.
In the NFL, concussions are under great medical scrutiny.
ESPN
but
interview in New York Times.
I want you to
We've
say the month
everywhere.
Of the year backwards to me.
Everybody here?
Athletic concussions are a growing public health concern.
6 years ago, Max Conrad played quarterback and defensive end for Walport High School in Oregon. After taking several hard hits during this game, a doctor said he suffered a concussion, but Max played the next Friday night.
Back to throw. Here comes the blitz, and he's going to get mauled over.
Max took several more hits in that game. And then, at halftime, he collapsed unconscious on the sidelines. He spent the next 2 months in a coma. In Max's case, his brain was severely damaged, and his life forever altered.
What happened?
What happened?
Yeah.
You were hurt in a football game.
What?
Yeah?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Teenagers often compete without proper medical supervision.
Max's father, Ralph, says that his son's high school did not have a sufficient medical staff.
There was no certified athletic trainer at the game. There was no doctor at the game.
There are probably only 23% of the schools in the United States, high schools in the United States, that have athletic trainers.
Obviously, the goal would be to have a certified athletic trainer at every high school. But for financial reasons, that, you know, isn't realistic. And so right now, because of that, and because of the liability involved, it falls on the coaches.
This is a question, did I check on him?
Yeah.
Yes, I did.
Okay, how did you check on him?
How are you feeling?
Tell me if you need a break. Yeah? Okay.
They're very busy individuals that pour their heart and soul into coaching, but they're not medical professionals.
He said he'd had a headache over the weekend. His mom, he was up all night. He had some headache pills.
The kid had symptoms of a concussion. He should not have gone in, period.
Medical professionals got together and let us know that he's waiting a week. He's asymptomatic before he goes in.
He returned to play prior to becoming symptom-free for a period of time. You are at a high risk for a syndrome where suddenly lack of control of blood flow to the brain develops, the brain floods, the pressure becomes massive, and death or major morbidity occurs.
I had my brain injury, and I want to go on with my life.
And although he says he dreams of being a writer, it isn't easy for Max to use his computer.
If you had any advice for high school football players, what would it be?
Check the date of the helmet. My helmet was 20 years old.
Tripped up by Conrad, took it in the head too, as he got run over by Warren.
I felt really betrayed when I found out that he had a 20-year-old helmet.
Max's helmet was made in 1981 and then later reconditioned. He filed a lawsuit against the company that did the reconditioning, and it was settled out of court.
Medical experts do say that even reconditioned older helmets can increase the risk of concussions.
Blink for me if Katie's in the room. She's in the room, yeah.
I want to do everything that I planned on doing.
Close, in the 8 years since his injury, how many times has your coach called you or asked to see you? Third time.
Now he got a promotion.
He's superintendent of schools.
Yeah.
He was a principal and then a superintendent of schools in Oak Ridge.
Thank you very much. You've done an incredible job. I think you've clearly wrapped up why this is an important bill, and I'm sorry that you had to experience this. I mean, that's a tremendous loss for you, and I know sitting by a hospital bed for your child and doing everything you can to help them get better, there's nothing quite like that. And I'm glad you're both here, and if there aren't any questions, we can close the public hearing and move
Please.
This bill.
Ask any good. Questions.
All right. I think we're good. Okay. Thank you very much, and best of luck. Right. Thank you.
Hey, it's so good to say yes.
I think you got us.
All right.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Max's bill, which is House Bill 348. Senate Bill 348, and open a work session on Senate Bill 348, which is called Max's Law. Do I have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill
348 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Denver moves Senate Bill 348A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? No? Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Yes.
Representative Comp?
Yes.
Representative Maurer?
Excuse.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Yes.
Vice Chair Denbrough?
Aye.
Chair Gelzer?
Aye. Having received the required votes, the bill passes and goes to the floor for final approval because it's already come through the House. Representative Comp, would you carry?
Oh yeah.
Representative Comp, would you like to carry this bill?
I would love to carry this bill.
Thank you very much. And Max, thank you again. Thank you for sharing your story. You're going to help a lot of other young people,
yeah,
and you're going to save some lives. So thank you very much for coming up and making it happen.
Thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome. Yeah. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 348.
Yes, that's right. Debbie and
I will get pom-poms.
Go cancer.
And if someone could call my children and tell them that someone said that about me, my weekend might be much better. All right, I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 512.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 512A, we have a number of speakers with respect to this, so I won't spend a great deal of time. There is an amendment with respect to this. Essentially, this bill replaces provisions of Senate Bill 1092 from the 2008 special session. Requires notice of certain offenses to school administrators or superintendents of school districts for youth within jurisdiction of the juvenile court. It also goes into a great deal of detail with respect to what these notices should include. The amendments add some additional circumstances in which notices may begin, and also provides additional information to be included. We do have the fiscal and the revenue with respect to this measure. So,
thank you very much. And I'll call up Lane Shetterly, Mark Comstock, and Christy Nielsen, all from the Oregon Law Commission. And we'll see if you can top that.
Madam Chair, I think we know better than to try.
Sure. Although I think that Lane Shetterly might support the Beavers.
Yes. Madam Chair, having being a graduate of Oregon College of Education, of course, it's always been the Wolves close to my heart. But for the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lane Shetterly. I am an attorney in practice in Dallas, and am here before you today. Just to provide a brief introduction to Senate Bill 512, because it comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. Those of us who serve on the Oregon Law Commission spend plenty of time during the session, typically in front of the Judiciary Committees, but it's not so often that we get to speak to other policy committees of the chambers. And so I just wanted to spend a few minutes laying out a little bit of background about the Law Commission and how this bill came to you today. The Oregon Law Commission was created by the legislature in 1997 to conduct an ongoing program of law reform. It is, by statute, consists of the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, the Attorney General, the deans of the three law schools, three members appointed by the Oregon Bar Association, one member appointed by the governor, two members appointed by the speaker, and two members appointed by the Senate president. And many of the projects that the commission undertakes come from recommendations by attorneys and judges around the state, but it is not uncommon for the legislature to ask the law commission to take up a project and deal with an issue that the legislature wants to have fully considered before enacting legislation. And that is how Senate Bill 512 comes to you. It goes back to Senate Bill 1092, which was introduced and acted on during the special session in February of 2008 regarding the requirement of notice to schools when students have pending and past juvenile delinquency proceedings. That was the issue in Senate Bill 1092, the matter of providing notice to schools so that schools could be apprised of those circumstances. But because of the truncated nature of that one-month session and the speed with which this bill had to come forward, it was expressed at the end of that session that there were still issues that the legislature wanted to have worked out, even as it enacted Senate Bill 1092. And so it asked, the bill was amended to direct the Oregon Law Commission to take up the bill and give further consideration to some of the loose ends that the legislature still felt were dangling. And so a work group was formed. Mark Comstock, who is with me, an attorney here in Salem, is a commission member, chaired the work group. He will identify to you who the members were of the work group. It was broadly representative of the interests around this bill. It was not an easy process. If those of you who were here in February of 2008 may remember, Senate Bill 1092 as not being an easy bill. There were substantial policy considerations and quite a bit of disagreement about certain aspects of it, even as it was being enacted. Those issues were worked out in the work group that met several times between the February session and the beginning of this session. And I'm pleased to say that what you have today, finally, is really a consensus product. The bill was introduced. It was approved by the Law Commission, introduced in the Senate. There were some amendments made in the Senate that have been endorsed by the members of the work group and by the Law Commission. You have the eight amendments, I believe it is, yes, that are largely technical in nature. Christy Nielsen will talk to you about those, but those also have the support of the Commission and the work group members. And so it's my pleasure to bring to you, hopefully, just now, approaching the finish line, what has been a very challenging project because of the interests and the nature of the interests involved, but one that we feel we have carried out effectively and brought you a bill that the legislature can adopt and finish the work that really was begun with Senate Bill 1092. With that, I'll conclude my testimony and perhaps offer Mark Comstock an opportunity to go further into this, and then to say Christy Nielsen will give you the rundown on the bill itself. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Mark Comstock. I'm a lawyer practicing in Salem. About half my practice is representing school districts. So as a newly appointed member of the Law Commission, I got tagged, shall we say, to lead the work group. And what the work group consisted of was Senate Bill 1092 and bringing together many of the stakeholders, I'd say all of the stakeholders, to this group. We had representatives of the Oregon Department of Education, the Oregon Department of Human Services, Oregon Youth Authority, Oregon Judicial Department, Oregon Education Association, Disability Rights Oregon, Juvenile Rights Project, and ACLU Oregon. We also had, as members of the work group, Representative Buckley, a Multnomah County Senior Deputy District Attorney practicing in the juvenile area, the presiding judge of Polk County Circuit Court, the Oregon City School District high school teacher, superintendent of the McMinnville School District, a school psychologist from Salem-Keizer School District, and various attorneys practicing representing both parents and juveniles. With that group, you can imagine it was like herding cats, but we did get to a consensus, and that became Senate Bill 512, which was to make Senate Bill 1092 more workable for all of the people, and especially the school districts. What the bill does is provide notice to schools of juveniles who are charged with certain crimes that might indicate there is a safety risk to schools, provides follow-up notices for when there is a disposition or an adjudication, a dismissal, or a finding of no jurisdiction, and adds information to the notice, and specifically identifies who is to give the notice and to whom the notice is to be given to make it workable in the school districts, because really having a safe school environment is
a very important part of what this bill seeks to work. And finally, the 512 corrects some drafting errors that takes care of transfer students and allows the schools to get relevant information regarding disciplinary history of students coming from outside the state. So at least we have warning of how these students may impact the school environment. With that, I'll turn it over to Christy, who will talk about the amendments and some of the technical aspects, and I'll certainly be available for questions. Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Christy Nielsen. I'm the staff attorney for the Oregon Law Commission. I just want to briefly highlight some of the important changes that we made to the bill, to Senate Bill 1092, to help to achieve some of the goals that Chair Comstock mentioned. Going through the bill chronologically, the bill is first and foremost reorganized to make it easier to read. I think that's just an important basic change that was made to the bill. It starts with who is a school administrator, and it's important to have this clearly defined because these are the people who are receiving these notices. So it accounts for all circumstances of public school, private school, charter schools, the school for the blind, and so forth. Then it goes to what events trigger the notice of schools. Previously in 1092, it was only when a student was charged and then a follow-up notice was given when the case was dismissed or when the youth was found to not be within the jurisdiction of the court. One hole that we found then is that if they are found guilty, which is arguably what information the schools would want to have, that was not to be noticed. So we added that notice that now with every disposition of the case, no matter how it is, how it goes through the process, once the petition is filed, either it's dismissed, they're found guilty, they're found not guilty, or otherwise, there's always a follow-up, so schools know exactly what happens with all of these kids that they're getting notices about. Again, then the content of the notice was improved, that all the previous provisions were retained, but new sections were added, such as conditions of release or conditions of probation. Again, this is information that the schools really want to know. Are they not to have contact with a certain student? Are they not to have access to fire and Bunsen burners in the chemistry class? These are important things that they need to know about. And whether school attendance is a term of probation, because that's usually included in probationary cases. It allows for the notice to be provided by the DA as a default, but if they agree with juvenile departments, the juvenile department can give the notice. A lot of counties operate these juvenile cases through their juvenile departments rather than DA's offices, and requiring it to come from the DA's office just didn't make sense practically with the way that most counties run their juvenile departments. And then it also focuses on the crimes that trigger the notice to the schools as those that that the stakeholders felt that schools would really want to know about rather than just all types of crimes. The second section of the bill talks about what the school has to do with the notice. So this is left fairly loose, mostly to allow for schools to set up their own procedures or protocols to do whatever works best for them. We didn't want to mandate any sort of administrative process that they would have to go through. Some important things that did have to be included, though, is that the initial recipient has to pass the notice on to the appropriate personnel within a certain period of time, and that they have to remove any documentation relating to a notice when there's been a dismissal or a finding of not guilty so that those erroneous notices are not following the student throughout their educational career. And again, as Chair Shetterly mentioned, transfer students, there was an interesting use of a legal term in there that made that entire transfer student section completely unworkable and that schools weren't getting any notice of transfer students. So we fixed that, and now that major focus of the bill back in 2008 can actually be carried through with this new bill. The remaining sections relate to pre-existing notices that are already sent under law prior to 1092, such as when a youth is charged with a Measure 11 crime. We took these notices and made them all uniform so that DA's offices or juvenile departments can just use the same form and check the correct boxes however they want to figure that out, so to try to relieve some administrative burden on these offices. And then briefly, I'd like to go through the A8 amendments that we asked for as the bill was passing through the House side. We were continuing to take it back to the work group and ask for input, and a couple of work group members and other interested parties brought to our attention some technical fixes that needed to be made to the bill, and in the spirit of making it a whole and the best product possible, we asked for those so that they could be fixed. The first one is to add a notice where a youth is found responsible except for insanity. As I mentioned before, there's a notice. If they're found guilty, there's a notice that they're found innocent, but that is one finding that could happen at the end of a case that wasn't included, and we wanted to make sure that all notices had the follow-up, the end result. Number two and number three are purely technical, that they came from the juvenile code work group, and they just wanted to fix the language so that it was exactly mirroring practice and what would be given in those circumstances. The fourth one allows for private school students or students who are on inter-district transfers. They were kind of a category of students that were left out of the original bill and just sort of an oversight, and so we wanted to make sure that they were included in here. And then number five fixes a redundant provision that was actually put in 1092 and takes it back to pre-1092 language so that the juvenile departments who are sending out a monthly probation list are only sending out what the exact crime that they were charged with if it's under a certain category. And so that really alleviates some administrative burden on their part as well. And finally, just a practical amendment, number six, was to provide contact information for whoever is sending the notice so that if the schools have questions, then they can call the DA's office or the juvenile department and find out more information. In the end, this bill is really about trying to facilitate discussions between these groups of people, and so we're trying to make it as easy as possible. And we urge your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Huffman.
Not a question, but I just want to thank Lane and the commission. I think when we worked on this last year, it started out being, oh, great, you know, we want to protect everybody at school, kids and everybody else, then the attorneys got involved. Sorry, Andrew. And we found out pretty quickly that it was...
Don't slap like
me, Kevin. Found out pretty quickly it was getting complicated, but we were fortunate enough to get something out and ask the commission to step in, and I appreciate the work.
Thank you very much. Any further questions or comments? I know this has been extraordinary work with a lot of diverse and competing interests in the outcome, and it is always exciting to see some unity when it comes to its last stop. And on that note, I would excuse the three of you and invite up Maura Roach and Lori Wimmer. Welcome.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roach. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Juvenile Rights Project. I've submitted for the record a memo from one of our attorneys, and which I will not be reading to you. I just want to say that I think we're at a place where this bill, you know, is a fair and balanced approach that meets the safety needs of schools, but doesn't infringe upon the rights of juveniles in a pre-adjudication notice process, and always love a 10-month interim negotiation. So we're fully in support of the final product, and appreciate the support of the committee and others who helped us get there.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wimmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association, and we, too, are in support of the bill with the amendments in front of you. Over on the Senate side, we had a little bit different perspective on the original bills introduced, but we're happy to work in a cooperative way with all the different parties to get to the resolution that resulted in the passage of the bill out of the Senate, and we think with these final technical tweaks, it's just perfect now. And so we are looking forward to the ability of schools to make sure that staff and students alike are as safe as possible, because they'll be armed with only that information which they need to have. We'll keep confidential. It's not meant to stigmatize anyone, but simply to make the school environment safe for all folks, including the juveniles in question. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Any questions for these two?
She just answered it.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else that wants to be heard on this bill before I close the public hearing? Going on. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 512, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 512A. Representative Dimbro.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 512A.
Representative Dimbro moves the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 512A, dated 5409. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Chair.
Representative Kahn.
Thank you. Just a comment. I really appreciate the work that went into this. I was not supportive of the original bill that we looked at in 08. In particular, I appreciate the focus of what happens when a student transfers. That sometimes that gets real muddled, and it's just real important that their rights, students' rights, not be violated. But it's, boy, what a great compromise.
Okay, thank you. Well, can we finish this motion on the amendment more discussion when we get to the motion on the bill?
Gotcha.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection to the amendment? Okay, so ordered. Amendment adopted. Representative Dimbro.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 512A to the floor, 512A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dimbro moves Senate Bill 512A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And starting our further discussion, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In addition to the commission, as Representative Comp said, a big thanks to everybody that worked on the work group. I know it was a huge task, and just wanted to make sure that everybody was thanked.
Thank you very much. Any further discussion? Representative Roblin.
I just wanted to confirm how important it was that Representative Huffman made the comment that we cared about kids, because I agree when we were here working last time. And I'm really pleased that everybody else chose to care about kids and get this worked out. So, thanks.
Any further discussion? Now, I too really appreciate the work on this. I too was a no on this bill in 2008, and am pleased to see the improvements in it this time. With that, Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Yes.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative
Powell? Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Excused.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dimbro?
Aye.
Chair Gelser?
Aye. Having received the required votes, the motion passes and the bill goes to the floor. Representative Huffman, would you like to carry this one?
Sure.
So Representative Huffman will carry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 512A. And the House Committee on Education is adjourned.